City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.
This is Talk to Trisha on City Talk 105.9.
I met my next guest when he became a regular expert on my TV show. His name's Drew McAdam, and you might have seen him on my show as the interrogator, a kind of human lie detector who can separate truth from fiction by scrutinising body language and voice characteristics. Anyway, I realised although I knew what he could do, I'd never really asked him why he did it. In fact, he's done all sorts of things over the years. Apparently, he's worked for the Army Intelligence Service, he's been a firefighter, and he's even tried his hand at music journalism. Well, in the last few years, he's become an entertainer who amazes audiences with his mind-reading skills. But Drew doesn't like the term magician. He prefers to think of himself as a student of human nature. So let's meet him now and find out more. Drew, a very big welcome to City Talk.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be on here, I must say.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you've had a variety of different jobs, but what did you want to do when you were little?
I wanted to do everything when I was little. I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to fly in helicopters. I wanted to be a fireman. I wanted to be a spy. I wanted to write. And the real beauty, I have to say, is that with the exception of being an astronaut, I have actually fulfilled every one of my boyhood ambitions.
You've been a spy?
Well, an intelligence officer. I saw the James Bond films and thought that looks good, but it's not quite as honourable a profession as I first thought, and not quite the same. It's not James Bond at all.
When you say not quite as honourable a profession, what do you mean? You have to get your hands dirtier than one would like?
It can be a very seedy world, yes. Working overseas and never being your own boss, I suppose, to a certain extent, and finding out that perhaps there are humans. If you have a good view of humans, and I like people, I really do people, you suddenly realise that there are people out there that are not good.
And do you think that sort of taints your view of the world?
It did for a certain length, a period of time, it did. It changed the way that I thought about things, but I managed to beat it again. And now doing the job that I do, I only work with people that I like. It's wonderful.
Now, we touched on Army intelligence there. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us anything about what, in general, what it involved? Are you allowed to talk about it, or will you have to kill us?
It's probably hours and hours of tedium followed by 10 seconds of total terror to a certain extent. I mean, I went into the TA. It was just something I really wanted to do, so I started in the Territorial Army.
Yeah.
And I didn't like the idea of having to sleep in ditches and drive around in Land Rovers and have my hair cut short, so intelligence seemed to be the way to go. As it turns out, actually, the basic training was something that I enjoyed very much, and I ended up being best recruit for some strange reason. And
What sort of training do they do? Because is it along the lines of have you incorporated that into future sort of professional life?
There are certain aspects of it that I have. For example, the interrogation techniques, which comes down to really comes down to spotting things which are wrong.
Right.
It's impossible to observe everything that's going on round about you.
Yeah.
But if you teach yourself, you can start to begin to notice items that are wrong, events that there's just something not quite right. It's almost like you switch on your computer, the hard drive starts making a funny noise. You know that there's something not right, and it's being able to work that out.
Is it tiny little things, though?
It tends to be, yes. It's just observing things. I mean, people don't observe things. If you ask most people what the number 6 is on their watch, whether it's an ordinary Arabic 6, whether it's a Roman 6, whether it's a dot, they won't be able to tell you. Most people can't even tell you which way the Queen's head faces on a coin.
Oh, I can't. Oh, that's a good question.
And yet you've seen that thousands of times. Now, if we don't observe those things, that we see day in and day out, what hope is there for us? So the idea is to just be trained to observe things that people don't normally notice.
Because that's what you said initially, a lot of boredom followed by terror.
Yes.
So I'm guessing that the boredom bit was just the sitting still and being hyper...
Watching, yes. I mean, you're collecting information, you're collating information, you're building up a picture. It's like a jigsaw.
And then you have to do something about it.
Well, yeah, hopefully somebody else does something about it, because they're often involved in that aspect as well.
But, you know, all of us believe that there is something good about it. And you said, and you do work really wonderfully with people, and we'll come to that in a moment. But are there people who are just bad, 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 or were the naughty people basically just doing their job? I mean, even if you're a terrorist, you believe what you're doing to be right. Mm-hmm. Does it mean you're bad through and through, or you just work for the other side?
This is just purely my own point of view, but I would say that there are some people in this world that have no souls.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What, can you tell that when you look at them through observation, or how do you come to that conclusion? What makes you feel that those people have no souls?
I've just met people that, to my mind, just cannot be human. Mm. They can't possibly be human. One of the things about being human is that we have empathy.
Yeah.
With other people. We're able to put ourselves in their shoes and to feel what they feel. And a lot of my mind reading, for want of a better word, involves putting myself in somebody else's shoes, being able to think like them.
Right.
But there are some people that have no empathy.
That must be really scary. I mean, you talk about mind reading or even interrogation, what have you. When you come face to face with somebody, as you say, and I, on my show, that's exactly the same thing I do on the chat show. I try and put myself in that person's, mm-hmm. Where they're coming from, to hear their story.
Mm-hmm.
And some occasionally, as you say, you'll sit down with someone and you'll put yourselves in their shoes, and literally a shiver will run up your spine.
Yes. Uh-huh. I mean, psychological profiling, getting inside somebody's head, can be quite a scary thing to do sometimes, depending who's in front of you. But the thing is, though, that most of us are alike rather than different. For example, the sort of thing that I do, if you say to most people, think of a vegetable, most people will think of a carrot. If you say think of a wild animal, most people will think of a lion. So we're more alike than we are different. But there are people out there that, to my mind, just are not human.
So they come up with a tomato, a tarantula.
I don't know what's going on in there.
So was it, you know, talking about interrogation, was it when you were working with Army Intelligence that you became interested in all of that area?
Well, you know, Tricia, it goes back to actually when I was very young. I was fascinated by the paranormal. And
right.
I always wanted to be able to investigate telepathy and telekinesis and all these sort of things. And I found that, in fact, I couldn't do it.
Right.
I was absolutely hopeless. But, for example, and this is kind of giving away trade secrets, but I'm sure you don't mind.
Oh.
If I ask somebody to think of a simple shape, perhaps a circle or a triangle or a star, and to visualize it on a screen, there's a thing called idiomotor response. Every thought you have has a physical reaction.
Okay.
It betrays what you're thinking. And all I had to do, as long as they were really concentrating on drawing that on a big screen, all I had to do was watch the tip of their nose. And it would actually trace out that shape.
Really?
Yeah.
So they'll do a circle, slight circle?
You'll see that slight circle. You can do that if you say to somebody, give them a pound coin, get them to put it behind the back, put it in either hand, bring both hands out in front of them.
Yeah.
And then you have to kind of script it to a certain degree, but you get them to concentrate on the feeling of the coin, the weight of the coin, the hardness, whether it's getting warmer.
Mm.
And then to slowly separate their arms till they're at either side.
Right.
And just watch the tip of their nose, because whichever coin the hand is in, the nose will be pointing ever so slightly in that direction.
Oh, my gosh, are you really? You're talking about the observing and what have you.
Yes,
so,
yes.
So when we're questioned, what you're saying is there might be one thing that comes out of our mouths, but our bodies may be doing something completely different.
Yes, we've all seen that. And not just out of your mouths, but sometimes with paralanguage, the way somebody says something. You must have been in a restaurant or in a reasonably crowded situation.
Hmm.
And there's somebody behind you telling a tall story.
Right.
And you know that it's a tall story. You don't know how you know, but you know. And it's because they're under a little bit of stress. The pitch of their voice has gone up slightly. Their sentence structure has shortened. That sort of thing. And you just pick it up almost by intuition.
I'm talking to Drew McAdam about, well, we'll come to mind play in a moment, but this is absolutely fascinating, Drew. Do you think it's something we learn, or most people learn with age? Because surely it must be a reason why we adults can spot when teenagers, for instance, are telling porkies. You don't exactly know how, but if you know somebody well enough, I suppose like animals, we pick up that something, as you said earlier, is not right.
Exactly. Only 27% of all communication is verbal. The rest uses non-verbal cues. And we do all the time. So, for example, you might walk into a room and there's somebody there that you've never met before.
Right.
But in that instant that you meet them, you know whether they're pleased to see you or not without a word being spoken.
Yeah.
Now, that's remarkable. That is mind-to-mind communication.
And you think, well, that's just an animal, almost animal instinct?
Yes. Yep.
It's like my dog goes grrr when he...
Yep, or if you watch dogs, they will approach each other by the flank. They don't go face to face. You know, so
right.
Even that, you know, is there was a fantastic... Have you ever heard of Hans the Clever Horse?
No, tell us about Hans the Clever Horse.
Is he
the one who counted?
Yeah, that's the one that could do arithmetic.
Yes.
So people would say, what's 2 plus 2? And the horse would hit its hoof 4 times. And it made a lot of money for its owner until some scientists put some blinkers on it, and then suddenly the horse couldn't do it anymore. Because what was happening is that once it started, they would say 2 plus 2, the horse would start hitting its hoof, people would lean forward in anticipation. Once it got to 4, they relaxed, and the horse stopped doing it. So the horse can read body language. So all I'm really doing is what a horse did 100 years ago, I suppose.
Now, are there common gestures or movements that everyone makes under pressure without realising?
It tends to be different with different people. And again, what you're...
Well, are men and women different? Or?
Oh, yeah, yes. There's a great thing that women do. Now that I'm telling you this, you'll be seeing it everywhere. Women of a certain age that are still single and are looking for a partner.
Right.
When they walk into a bar... will do what's called a predatory gaze. And if you ever watch a predator when it's hunting for food, it moves its eyes, and then a second later its head will follow its gaze.
Right.
That's what women do when they walk into a bar, if they're kind of on the lookout for a partner.
And what about, but men are different?
Well, what happens if the men are at the bar, they pick up this predatory gaze and they start acting like gazelles and moving away, and then the women say, I can't get a man, I don't understand.
Really, men move away from that predatory gaze?
Yep.
They don't move towards it?
No, nobody likes a predatory gaze. I sometimes do at the beginning of a show. I will stand and I will look at the audience and I will move my eyes perhaps to the right. Then my head will follow. Then my eyes will move to the left. Then my head will follow. And you can see people visibly shrinking in the seats. It makes them very uncomfortable because it's like a predator looking at you and thinking, food. And then I'll smile and they relax and then we're into it.
So could you teach a woman of a certain age who can't get a partner, could you look at her body language and say, you're doing this all wrong? So what would be the correct way to do it then?
There are lots of different ways and it depends on the lady herself. I've done it with solicitors, teaching them how to be able to make their client feel more relaxed and to trust them more. And again,
don't charge them.
That comes down to rapport and empathy, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But what about, you know, you said that was a woman, but what happens with a man? Do they have a different kind of predatory gaze?
Not really, no. It's men are much more open with it, I think, because they're on the hunt anyway and they don't care who knows.
Right. Because there was something that came out recently that said that women were wasting their time if they used flowery talk with men, that they should just come down to the basics. I swear it was written by a male journalist. But I'm guessing even in communication with the spoken word, there are a completely different approaches as well.
Yes, yes. There is that, again, I suppose it's the old adage that you've got 2 ears... and 1 mouth, and that's the proportion in which they should be used.
Ah, okay. I'm talking to Drew McAdam. We're going to take a short break, and after we'll be talking more about mind play, how he can get inside your head. Back after this.
This is Talk to Tricia on City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back. You're listening to Talk to Tricia here on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool. I'm talking to Drew McAdam. Now, what kind of ticks or movements show you that someone's being dishonest?
The main one that people can't seem to get rid of is the touching the mouth. And that goes back to children. If you ask a child, they lie. They don't want the bad words to come out. So the hand will come up to the mouth. And we still do this strange mouth touching. And oddly enough, whether you're left or right-handed, people will do it with their left hand. I don't really know why, but we do.
Ah, and anything else? Is there, you know, is it a whole load of a cluster of gestures or just one thing?
Yeah, you used the right word there. It is a cluster. Simple things like, for example, if you're under a bit of stress, your blood pressure goes up, and where the blood vessels are closest to the surface will begin to tingle. So, for example, the ear lobes and the nose, so you get nose touching and you get ear touching when people are under stress. In fact, I did hear, I've never been able to find out if this is true, but apparently police officers will often watch for a driver who, as they go past, will tug their ear lobe or give their nose a little rub because they know that that person's under stress for some reason, it's seeing them. So there's something not right. Now, the next time you drive past a police car, I'll bet you your ear starts to tingle.
Well, now. Now, Drew, people on my TV show, they often think that they can fool you or beat a lie detector, and I've got to say, they're usually wrong. Mm-hmm. But is it possible for people to train their bodies to hide their feelings of guilt or fear? And going back to your career in army intelligence, surely you must have been dealing with people who had some training not to give anything away.
Yes, it is possible to beat the polygraph. There are ways to do that, the lie detector machine, the actual lie detector itself. There are ways to beat that, if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And these are quite well-known skills. However, your body will always betray when you're lying. If you try to cover up one thing, I can guarantee it will come out somewhere else. There's a thing I do on stage where I give five people boards. Each of them does a drawing. They're then mixed up. The boards are handed to me one at a time, and I ask each person, did you draw this? And all the answer is no. Now, I do put them under a little bit of stress, but I then point out to the audience how I know which one's lying.
And how can you tell if somebody's lying?
There are various ticks and tells that people have. Hmm. It may be something as simple as they're trying not to nod their head. They're trying to say no, but their brain's thinking yes, and it's getting confused, so they'll hold their head very, very still, and what you'll find is that they'll start tapping their foot instead.
As you said, something springs out. But by training, I mean, I'm looking at your website, amazing website, by the way. It says you can stop your pulse or reduce your pulse. Is that part of the training? Can you do that?
Yeah, but that's one of these things, though, that interested me for many, many years, those sort of things. Now, there are simple magician tricks to do things like that. Hmm. I've done it where I've been wired up to some sort of machine that measures your pulse and so on.
Yeah.
And you feel it just going away. And I did it once very stupidly with a nurse who worked on a terminal ward, and it completely freaked her.
But how can you tell us how you do that? Is it meditation? Is it that kind of thing?
There's a lot of that going on. The way that I do it, yes. Mm. I don't really want to go into that part of it because that's almost one of those kind of visual things that I do rather than to do with the mind. But it's down to training your own mind, lowering your blood pressure, all that sort of thing. I'm just fascinated by the human mind and what it can actually do.
So if you could do all of those things then, could you use those techniques not to give anything away if you were being interrogated, for instance?
No.
You still couldn't?
It's impossible.
So even if you managed to do all of that, something would still give you away?
Yes. Yeah. Cool. And there are various techniques. Now, some of the techniques which I used on your show were never actually shown on screen.
No.
I'm quite happy
to
say that.
Away.
Sorry?
We didn't want to give too much away.
Yes, exactly. But it would kind of spoil it for other people who are coming on later. But hopefully you had a chance to see some of these things where I would say to the person, for example, whether he was lying or not, I didn't really care at the very beginning, but I would perhaps get him to think of somebody to whom he was emotionally close and their door number.
Right.
And I would get them to concentrate on the door number, and I would write something down on a piece of paper. And I'd say, yeah, I've committed myself in writing, I can't change my mind now. What was the door number? They say, perhaps 36. I turn around the piece of paper and it's got 36 written on it. I then explain, look, I'm inside your head. It's pointless lying to me.
Now, and you can't tell us how you do that.
No. Well, again, that's down to, you know, it's part of the shows that I do. It looks like mind reading. They are then convinced that I'm inside their head. It's pointless lying anyway. And they're quite happy to open up.
Because I remember with one guy with a theft, and he didn't do it, but he knew who had. And you wrote down the name on that piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And when we handed it to the person who'd accused him of stealing, they sort of blanched and what have you. So it was absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for people, I must have a look at your website and see what you do. And I'll come to that in just a second. But are there techniques that we can use to enhance the way we come across in social or work situations? We're talking about being naughty and lying, but mm-hmm. but what and not going in and staring like a wild beast. But what can we do to come across in a more positive light?
Well, the first thing to do, of course, is to build up rapport so that the person likes you, but they just don't know why.
How do you do that?
Well, one simple way to do it, for example, when you meet somebody and you shake hands with them, and you would normally look them in the eye anyway, but instead of just gazing in the eye, look in their eye and think to yourself, what colour are their eyes? Now, the look that they get is completely different. It's almost a romantic look.
Oh, really? Do politicians do that, do you think?
I would hope not. I don't want them to know these things. I don't want salespeople to know these things either.
Oh, gosh. So actually, thinking about their eye colour changes the way, what, changes your eyes?
It changes your eyes, the way that you're looking at them. It's a totally different gaze rather than just a quick glance in their eye as you shake their hand. The other thing, for example, is to cock your head slightly to the side, because that's a very non-threatening gesture.
Like animals again.
Again, exactly, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And what about smiles? Are there some smiles that will draw people in and some smiles, you know, because I'm thinking of children's cartoons like Dick Dastardly. There are some smiles that are scary, I'm guessing, like an animal showing all their teeth, and some smiles that invite people in.
Well, smiles are interesting because there are a certain group of muscles under the eye which you can't actually control,
right,
no matter how much you try. With a genuine smile, you will see the smile and the eyes lift. You know the little crow's feet that you get?
Yeah.
It creates that. If you get a smile and those muscles aren't moving, that's not a real smile.
Yeah, but then what are you going to do, Drew, about that in this day and age? And I'm thinking of things like Britain's Got Talent, what have you. Certain people might have a lot of Botox going on.
Uh-huh.
I mean, with things like with Botox, freezing facial muscles, is that why we can feel uncomfortable with maybe women who've had a lot of work done on the face because nothing's moving and you can't read anything?
That's very interesting. You know something? I've never actually considered that, Tricia.
Ah.
I'm going to have a look at that, but that seems like...
No, because I just thought, I know some women, and no, I'm not going to give their mm-hmm. names away. Well, Amanda Holden's been very honest about it, but I've come across other women. She's a nice girl, but let's say Danny Minogue. And you can't read if you can't... Caprice is another one, who may or may not have done. but there are a lot of people you come across and you feel wrong-footed. You feel uncomfortable. You don't know why. And I guess it's because you can't see... There's nothing happening or very little happening in the face.
Tricia, I think you could become the next great mind reader. I'd never actually considered that, but I'm going to have a look. So, I mean, isn't it a fascinating world?
It's scary. See, I'm just saying Botox. If you had five women up there on stage who'd all had Botox to hell, you'd be in deep poo.
Well, yeah, there is also the listening to the voice and the actual body language. But in terms of facially, yes, you're absolutely right.
Oh, that's scary.
I'm scared now.
Yeah. Now, are there things that parents or bosses or you know, anyone can do to pull rank, you know, in other words, exert authority or take control, because that's one thing that you do on the show. Just for people who've just joined us, I'm talking to Drew McAdam. Drew, there's one thing you do on the show is command huge amounts of respect. Is there something we can learn from you about getting that respect? Because we talked about making people putty in our hands by looking them in the eye and noticing the colour of their eyes. What do you do to command respect when you walk into a room?
I have absolutely no idea. I really don't. The only thing I can say is, as I said earlier on, I really do like people.
But you've got a presence that commands respect. I mean, I've seen guests who are slumped, something almost, yeah, you know, going back to your military training, they almost come to attention. And it's almost yes sir, no sir, yes no. And so there's obviously something about the way you are that commands great respect. Is that just something that you don't even realise you're doing?
I don't, actually. I know I can look pretty scary sometimes, but that's bad, Drew. And we used to joke about that in the studio. They would say, are you getting yourself psyched up? And I'd say, no, I'm just worried in case bad Drew doesn't turn up today. I think it used to scare them a little bit.
But is it something with eye contact or something? Is there is the way someone who's... Because there's a pecking order in life, as there is with animals. Yes. Is there a way in which someone who believes themselves to be superior relates to somebody who they see as inferior and vice versa?
There is, but I think that would just come across as annoying. We all know people like that that think they're superior, and I don't think it is that. I think it's probably confidence in that I've done this sort of thing 1,000 times before. I get somebody in front of me who is going to attempt to lie to me, and I know that they don't stand a chance. I will be quite cold towards them, quite cold. I will then scare them by pointing out that I'm inside their head, but then I build up that rapport and empathy by explaining, look, if I was in your situation, I would do the same thing. It's almost as though psychologically I'm putting my arm around their shoulder, I'm taking them with me, and that's when they confess.
Is that a bit like the Stockholm syndrome? You know, that they say with hijackers and what have you, and everybody's scared. And then I know as an air stewardess in the Middle East, I worked there for 5 years. And that was one thing we were trained against, you know, that you could end up in the end going on to the side of the hijackers. Is that something along those lines?
It is. There's a lot of that in there. And people like to think that you're on their side. And certainly on your show, people were scared of going back out again, and if I wasn't on their side. So I built some of that as well. So there was a certain rapport. As far as they were concerned, I was their friend and I was going to help them.
Right. Now what about, let's talk for people out there who might be coming up to an interview or making a speech, a wedding or something like that. Are there techniques that we can use to endear ourselves to lots of people rather than, because we can't shake hands and look them in the eye each and every one. What do you do when you come out onto the stage? You said you do that predatory look that makes everyone think, eek.
But then,
how do you make people feel, you know, at ease? Oh, I like this person.
Well, you do it all the time, don't you? I don't know how you do it, but you put people at ease. You come out, there's a certain smile, confidence. They know that you like them, I think, is the main thing.
You actually like
the people in front of you. And that there are people in that audience that, if you spent enough time, would become lifelong friends with you. So there's that. But the main thing, I think, for people who are going to go into a very nervous or nerve-wracking period of standing up in front of people and talking, or an interview, as you were saying, is to understand that the physiology between being nervous and being excited are exactly the same.
Ah.
So your heart races, you get sweaty palms, and so on and so forth. And it was actually my mentor, who is a chap called Mark Salem, who's the professor of psychology at New York University, carried out an experiment in which he gave 100 students a medication which would raise their heart rate, would make their palms sticky, the whole thing. Half of the students were told, this will make you feel very nervous, just as though you were about to get up and give a speech.
Right.
The other half were told, this will make you feel very excited, like a child on Christmas Eve. And they all reported back that they experienced what they were told they would experience. So part of it is to take that nervousness yes. and think, no, I'm not nervous. I'm excited. This is going to be great. And then that comes over when you're actually on the stage, that you're really enjoying yourself.
We're talking to Drew McAdam about the fascinating things he gets up to crawling inside our minds. We'll be back with more after this quick break.
This is Talk to Tricia on City Talk 105.9.
Thanks for joining us again. You're with Tricia Goddard on Talk to Tricia, City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool. And I'm talking to someone we know on my chat show as the interrogator, but we're finding out a lot more about Drew McAdam. Now, how does your performance work differ from the sort of skills you use as the interrogator? As I said earlier, I've looked at your great website and you talk about mind play and what have you. And it is very different, so we should tell people that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, oh yes. The show itself and mind play and so on, I do it because I love doing it. It's mainly corporate gigs that I do. And to see people suddenly realise, wow, the mind is capable of far more than I thought it was. And it's almost that untapped potential of the human mind being held up for people to look at and realise that they're probably a lot better than they think they are. For example, I might use memory systems. And I did a four-part series with BBC, in which part of that I was teaching children how to memorise lists of 30 and 40 objects, forwards and backwards, within minutes.
Wow. Gosh, it just get me to memorise my name a
bit. But it's because we don't use them, our minds, in the most efficient manner.
But things like drugs and alcohol must interfere with the way our mind, obviously interfere with our minds.
Yes.
Are some people just so stupid that you can't communicate with them? And I don't mean, I'm not for a minute talking about people with disabilities. I mean, just dense, just not there, or so maybe disconnected.
I did some work with a charity with kids that were thrown out of the home, thrown out of school. And I did this where I wrote 20 objects on a board. And I said to one of the chaps, give me that list. Just memorise it and give me it. And he said, I can't do that. I can't do it. I said, no, just try. And he got two, maybe three.
Yeah.
And this was a person who wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed. But the worst thing was he didn't believe in himself. So I taught him the technique, which basically involves linking each object to the next in big cartoonish images in your mind. And he was very, very good at that. So he started at the top of the list and he went through it. And he got to the bottom and I turned the board around and said, now give me the list backwards. And he started with the last thing. And as he was working his way, his friends were looking at him in absolute awe. And there were tears running down his cheek because all these years, people had told him he was worthless. And all of a sudden, he could do something that most teachers or scientists can't do.
Oh, how lovely. Now, I know Uri Geller's a fan of yours, and you've been known to do the odd bit of spoon bending yourself. How did that start? Is that when you're laughing?
Well, Uri was on the BBC, I think it was Dimbleby Talk, in November 1973, bending spoons. And anybody that lived through that will remember it.
Yes.
And I watched it on the television, and I thought, that'll get me girls.
Did it?
Well, in the December, I was at the youth club Christmas party. I borrowed a friend's key. I rubbed it, it bent and it broke. We actually had to knock his parents up at 1:30 in the morning to get in. But I met my wife at that party, so I never did find out if it would actually.
Can you tell us how it works? Is it a trick or do you have to keep it quiet?
You know, we've been doing this for over 30 years. If it was a trick, they would have found it by now. Now, I have seen magicians doing it, using spoons that have got little hinges and so on hidden in the spoon. I buy hundreds of spoons and I leave them with people. But what I love about it is that people who see things which they thought was impossible and now they realise it's not impossible, and maybe other things in their own lives that seem to be impossible, perhaps aren't.
Ah, so you very cleverly sidestepped my question about how it actually works. Now, Drew, your website talks a lot about this technique we've mentioned a few times throughout this interview. You call mind play. What exactly is mind play?
Mind play is mentalism, and it's in America, everybody knows what a mentalist is.
There's a show, isn't there? There's a new TV
show. Yes, there
show
is, and it's actually very good. There are a lot of techniques being used in that, which we actually use. But to say that you're a mentalist, certainly in Scotland, means that you need to be in a rubber room somewhere.
Yes, it's pretty much.
It's very difficult because you don't want to say you're a mind reader, because I don't read minds. I don't even know if it's possible to read minds. But given the right situation, I can read a single thought that somebody has, if they're concentrating in the right way. I can influence the thoughts they have, and I can predict what thoughts they're going to have. So it's all psychology and science, but with a little bit of showmanship. And I'm not really a great showman. I must say, I'm not somebody that likes smoke and mirrors and lights. I like to be up there and people say, I could do that too. I can see how he's doing that, and it's clever.
Now, you said you can influence the way people think. How do you do that?
Here's an example for you. You get a piece of paper, and you write the numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4 on one side. On the other side of the paper, on the other side of the piece of paper, just write, but why did you pick the number 3? Then you hold the piece of paper up to somebody at the front just with the numbers, and you say, just pick a number from 1 to 4 and score it out. 90% of the time, people will score out the number 3, and then you can turn it around. Now, the reason that they're picking the number 3 is because you're saying, pick a number from 1 to 4. So you're saying 1, 2, and 4. And your brain fills in the one that's missing, and that's what pops into your head. You can't help it. So you're influencing the thought.
Right, I'm going to try that out.
You'll all be doing it tomorrow. Another thing giving an example in a show, I'll sometimes give people things to try. You get a piece of paper, you write on it, it's the 1812 Overture, and you pin it on the wall beside you. And then you just sit throughout the day, and just every 20 minutes or so, just for a few seconds, just whistle or hum a few bars from the 1812 Overture.
Yeah.
Now, I guarantee you, at some point, somebody will come past you, and they will be whistling or humming that tune. When they do, you say, stop, what's that tune? And while they're still thinking about it, you get them to open the piece of paper and it says, it's the 1812 Overture. So they're stunned, and you've just started your career as a psychic.
is that what psychics are?
It's
dangerous waters, but do you think a lot of being a psychic is about watching? I was once told by a psychic that what they did was to almost suggest something to you or go through a list of things. Mm-hmm. And when your eye, you gave away some sort of small movement, they saw that had some resonance with you, and that's where they homed in.
There's a very powerful psychological technique called cold reading.
Nice.
And that's a very small part of it. What you just mentioned there, Tricia, is a very small part of cold reading. It's very powerful. Some psychics are using that, and they're using it intentionally.
Yep.
Some psychics do it unintentionally, and they believe in themselves, but they're deceiving themselves to a certain extent. But having said that, I know how all these things work, and I've met people that can do things, and I can't explain it.
So do you believe in magic?
You know, I do.
You do?
I really do. I've seen things I just cannot explain.
But is that just because you haven't learned that particular technique? Or do you think everything's explainable if you have enough information? Or are there some things beyond the realms of possibility as we know it?
Well, obviously, once we get the explanation, I think there are some things just now where one day science will be able to say, this is what happens. But for the moment, we're sticking the label psychic on it. I'm not very keen on doing that because I know that one day we'll find out how these things happen. But I know people that have sat down with individuals and given them names, described their house, and there is nothing untoward going on. There's no hot reading, no cold reading, no psychology, no science. They just do it.
It's going to be interesting now with Google.
Isn't it? Yeah, well, Google Street Level.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
I know, I have.
You can, as long as
you could describe somebody's house or... you know, you could, if you had somebody, you know, on an earpiece and you had somebody in the back room there, you could be describing their front door and everything. The person would be going, hey, how do you do that?
Spiritualists have been using that sort of thing for years. It's not new. They've been able to drive past somebody's house or get the friend to go and drive past. They give them a description. But as I say, there have been things which I've seen and I can't explain them.
Now, if you could improve the image and the bearing of someone famous, who would you choose and what would you change?
Well, that's a difficult one.
Yeah. I mean, you just listening to you, you must sit and watch people on television, be the politicians, actors and actresses, and think, and you know, think they're lying, that's a lie, that's like, oh my God, you know, who would you change? Or who... I'll give you more than one.
You know, there are so many people that would be better at that than I. Certainly, Gordon Brown has a real problem in the way that he comes across. Now, I have heard that he's a very lovely man.
Yes, I've met him. He is very, very lovely. Yeah.
I did a show in Liverpool once. I was on with Liz McLaren from Atomic Kitten.
Oh, yeah.
Maggie Clark was there as well.
Right. Ah, yes, I've talked to Maggie.
Now, see, the two of them, they could teach any politician how to improve themselves.
Yeah,
and I think it comes down to they... I found that the two of them, when I met them doing that show, they have real empathy with people.
Yeah,
I mean, Liz McLaren, as you know, I'm not that at all. Liz McLaren, for example, said, oh, we must get a photograph together. She stood beside me, and as they went to take the photograph, she just buckled her knees, so she was down the same height as me.
Sort of did a Carla Sarkozy.
Exactly. You know, there's an empathy going on there somewhere, and that is often what it comes down to.
But I think with politicians, they might, especially politicians, it's scary. They don't know where the next salvo is coming from. They've got to be all things to all people, and that's got to be difficult.
Yes.
That has got to be difficult.
I mean, people are put in the firing line all the time. We mentioned Uri Geller earlier on. He's a very good friend of mine. And people have a go at him all the time.
Yeah.
And it just bounces off him. And he still comes over with this positive attitude, a cheerfulness, a real charm. I don't know how he does it. I don't know how he does it. But if some of our politicians could get some of that, whatever that magic pixie dust is,
but then you see in the States, they do. I mean, Obama, you're talking about all of the things you've been talking about, the looking in the eye, and Michelle Obama as well. Collectively, they seem to be able to work a crowd in a way that showmen must envy.
Oh, I would think so, yes. But, I mean, they do have a natural charisma, whatever that is. There was a show on the other night, we were talking about Britain's Got Talent.
Yeah.
With a lady not far from here, who everybody was laughing at when she stepped out. I don't know if you saw that program.
Yeah, but when she sang, everybody was blown away.
But she also filled that stage. She somehow filled that stage. Just with her arm gestures and the way she just blew a gentle kiss to the audience. There were things that she was doing that she just completely, for that time that she was on there, changed her completely. And I have no idea what that is. I wish I did.
So some people actually have it, but some people can be, I'm guessing, like we're coming back to animal instincts, some people can be like the scary wild animal who, through, I often say, through damage through early childhood and maybe years beyond, everything about the way they talk, they walk, the way they look is like a feral animal and makes people scared and hostile, which makes them, reinforces to them that they are scary, horrible people, and it bounces back and forth.
Yeah, it just becomes a vicious circle. Yes, you can see that happen quite a lot. And yet, oddly enough, some of these people who are the wildest are also the ones with the most energy, the most output. Some of the most successful businessmen that I know have that energy that if it wasn't channeled in a particular way, they would go bad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, because you said there's a good Drew and a bad Drew. so what's next for you, Drew? Do you have ambitions, I don't know, to do huge tricks like David Blaine, hang upside down in Perspex boxes over...
No, that's just not me. On stage, I come over just as a harmless person who's learnt to do some pretty cool things that we could all do. And I enjoy that. And I can't remember the last time I had the Monday morning blues. This job has taken me... I was doing spoon bending for this elderly American gentleman one time.
Yeah.
And I thought, I should know who you are. And I couldn't place him. He just reminded me of somebody. And it suddenly dawned on me, it was my hero, Buzz Aldrin.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, what other job is that? Why would I want to do more than this?
Oh, my God, exactly. But, I mean, so you've got it, as far as you're concerned. This is the best things could be.
Oh, yes, yes. I've no... Again, you know, the experience on your show was scary,
yeah.
It was exciting, I learned
yeah.
so much. There were wonderful, wonderful people to work with. And I just love doing those sort of projects and getting involved in it and getting yeah. the sleeves rolled up and taking it for what it is.
Now, I'm going to give something away about you, Drew, which, you know, there is a squishy side to you, because I know when I was first diagnosed, God, a year ago now with breast cancer,
mm-hmm.
you sent me that lovely little angel.
Oh, yeah, the angel, yeah.
And I just thought that was so sweet. That was that came at a time when you know, as I said to everybody, don't mention it at work. But mm-hmm. that really did touch me. That really did touch me.
You know, sometimes it is just little things though, like that. It doesn't take very much for us as human beings to just change things, and you never know what you're changing. It's ripples in a pond, isn't it?
It is ripples in a pond, because it was just, you know, because it was sweet, it was small, it was unexpected, and it just really gave me such a lift. And often you need something to hang on to and to believe in. And I thought, well, if tough guy Drew...
You know, I sometimes wear an angel, a little angel necklace, and I've noticed that Toya Wilcox wears one. It was specially made.
Yeah.
And it is, angel means messenger. And it's not that I'm a religious person or any of those sort of things, but I love the idea that we can all be angels, I suppose, in our own way.
So a messenger for you, your angel is what, for to remind you of something or to protect you from something? Or?
Oh, no, nothing like that at all. It's just a symbol almost that every time when I'm talking to somebody, I'm aware that I could end up influencing their life, and I'd better
right.
be damn sure that I influence it for the better.
Because
the sort of things that I do, the mind reading, the spoon bending, it's a whole different world to people. You're playing with their belief system.
Right.
So you can change that belief system. Now, some people will use that to start a cult,
yes.
For example. Some people will use it to put people down in order to make themselves look big.
Yeah.
I would rather do it so that person goes away with something that they'll never ever forget. And often, again, the bent spoon is a symbol. I have captains of industry, pop stars, who carry the spoon that they saw bent, and it's almost a symbol for them that just because somebody says something's impossible doesn't necessarily mean it really is.
So anything is achievable, or just about anything is achievable, given the time, discipline, belief mm-hmm. in yourself.
Once you know how it's done, that's right. And it's just sometimes that's all it takes to open people up. And I think that's a great thing to be able to do. You
Absolutely.
Almost leave a footprint to a certain extent. By the way, the one thing I always thought was impossible was to be able to lick your own elbow.
Go on, you can do... Lick your own elbow?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah, I always thought right. it was impossible. You're trying it now, aren't you?
Everybody's
trying
yeah.
it. It's gone, that's right. Yeah. I discovered that my granddaughter can. So even that one's gone now.
Drew, it has been absolutely brilliant, as I knew it would be. And I'm not psychic. I can't tell the future, but I knew it would be fantastic talking to you, Drew. Drew, we should tell people if they want to find out more about Mind Play, because I know you've done a lot of corporate things and what have you, they can go on to your website.
Yes. www.mindplay.co.uk. www.mindplay.co.uk.
Drew, as I said, it's been fantastic talking to
you.
Oh,
absolutely. My pleasure. It's been great.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. That was Drew McAdam. What a fascinating subject. What an absolutely fascinating subject. So you're going to go off now, aren't you? And you're going to practice some of those tricks. Shaking somebody's hand and looking them in the eye and noting the colour of their eye. I can see this happening in pubs all around Liverpool tonight. Guys are going to be pulling girls like nothing before. Drew has certainly started something. You're listening to Talk to Tricia here on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool.
Listen and log on to the voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.